from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Stuart Russell.
This week on War News Radio, we hear about this year's protests in Iraq and how they fit into the Arab Spring as a whole.
Then, we learn about a British human rights group that has filed litigation against the United States for its drone strikes in Pakistan.
Finally, we hear about the creation of the Afghan women's national soccer team, the challenges they've faced, and the successes they've had.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Fighting in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, has increased, with the rebel forces steadily gaining control of more sections of the city. Most significantly, rebel fighters, supported by NATO airstrikes and reinforcements, barged into Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Bab al-Azazia, running off with weapons and symbols of his 42-year rule. Though Gaddafi and his family were not found inside, the invasion of the compound was a powerful moment for rebel fighters and their supporters across the country. Rebel leaders say they have control of all but two neighborhoods in Tripoli, but acknowledge that the rebel groups occupying the capital are not all under unified command. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, who had been erroneously reported dead by rebel forces, has stated that his father is alive in Tripoli, and a radio broadcast by Gaddafi, in which he boasted of his tactful departure from Bab al-Azazia, confirms he is alive and well. In his most recent audio message, Gaddafi urged Libyans to continue fighting and go out and free Tripoli. Outside of the capital, Libyan rebels are receiving stiff resistance as they push towards Sirte in northern Libya, the hometown of Colonel Gaddafi. Meanwhile, NATO has said they will continue their mission of aiding the rebel groups in Libya until the pro-Gaddafi forces have backed down.
In the continuing conflict between Turkey and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, the Turkish army launched an air raid on suspected PKK bases in northern Iraq. Approximately 90 to 100 Kurdish rebels were killed, and another 80 were wounded. The PKK has increased their attacks on the Turkish military since July, the most recent of which left 9 Turkish soldiers dead and 14 wounded. In response to the attack, the Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, stated that the time for words was over and declared that now is the time for actions. Turkish military leaders say it is likely that future raids will occur. Kurdistan's parliament has been upset that the U.S. government has not recognized the Turkish attacks as a threat to Iraq's sovereignty. U.S. State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland did not condemn the attacks and said that Turkey has a right to defend itself.
Erroneous media reports say Warren Weinstein, an American who gunmen abducted in the eastern city of Lahore, Pakistan, was freed following a successful rescue operation. However, hours after the announcement, the Lahore police chief Malik Ahmed Raza Tahir stated that a rescue mission did not take place and that Weinstein's status could not be confirmed. The U.S. Embassy in Islamabad has also said that they have not been able to confirm that a rescue mission had occurred. No militant group has claimed responsibility for the abduction, and no ransom requests have been reported.
Syrian dissidents made progress this week in forming a national opposition council. Leaders of the opposition movement held meetings in Istanbul, Turkey, where they announced that a council would convene in Damascus in September. According to a prominent opposition figure, this council would consist of approximately 300 national and independent dissidents. However, although the uprising has made substantial progress in recent months against President Bashar Assad's regime, the movement still remains highly divided due to deep sectarian and ideological tensions. This is War News Radio. While the Arab Spring has dominated international news throughout much of 2011, not every uprising makes the headlines. War News Radio's Sarah Dwyder spoke to activists and a journalist in Iraq to find out how protests in Baghdad differ from others in the region and why they haven't gained the same traction.
Every Friday since February 25th, the Iraqi Day of Rage, protesters have gathered in Baghdad's own Tahrir Square. Inspired by the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, these young, secular, and media-savvy activists are demanding better public services, transparency, fair distribution of oil wealth, and an end to rampant government corruption. Yet even after clashes with government forces, and with reports of civilian casualties and the arbitrary detainment of activists, these frequent protests have been met with very little international media attention. According to Rawia Rogai, Al Jazeera's reporter based in Baghdad, protest fervor has spread across the city and across the nation.
There have been protests in multiple parts across the country, primarily obviously in the capital, Baghdad, in the equivalent of Tahrir Square, if you will, in Egypt. There is also a square here in Baghdad called Tahrir Plaza, and this was the beginning or the heart of the protest movement here in Baghdad.
Ragay says these protests have even spread to the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region, which is widely regarded as the model of democracy in Iraq.
Interestingly, also, there were protests in the Kurdistan region up north, and that's even, I guess, one of the more interesting spots because those were some of the more violent protests here in Iraq, if you will, were in the northern part, which is supposed to be the more democratic or the more advanced part of Iraq, if you will.
According to Haider Hamzaz, an Iraqi social media activist, the protesters' demands are simple: better services, more government transparency, and freedom of speech.
They need to reform the government. They need the good services. They need to stop the corruption that happened in Iraq, big corruption. They need to give these persons that do this corruption to law, under law, to protect the freedom of speech and don't attack the peaceful demonstration that happened in Iraq.
Rogai sees these demands as similar to those of protesters in other Arab nations.
In essence, the demonstrators or the protests here in Iraq have been calling for the same kind of demands that have been echoed across the Arab world, in the sense that they were rising up against poor services, against rampant corruption.
The one key difference, she says, is that Iraqi protesters do not go as far as calling for a new government.
There is a very distinct difference between the protests here and the rest of the Arab world. You don't hear people in Baghdad's Tahrir Square saying the people want regime change like you hear them or like you heard them in Egypt and Tunisia and now in Syria and Yemen. Those were more about poor services, lack of electricity, lack of water, in what is supposed to be one of the most rich countries in the world, if you judge by their oil wealth and reserves. So this was mainly a revolt against these poor services and rampant government corruption.
San Sarvan, an Iraqi activist, finds these demands surprising since they come from such a young population.
Some of them, they were underage. And they are not allowed to vote even. But they felt the frustration, they felt the corruption, they felt injustice, social injustice in this area, and that's the reason they get in the street. The majority of them, they were underage, like 16, 17 years old, workers and students, and after that, the students from university, they joined. Every day we had about thousands of students.
Hamzaz says these young activists find each other using social media.
The youth that organized that, some of them that activists in NGOs, and most of them they are activists on Facebook and social media networking.
He says that these young protesters have elicited a strong government response.
So we have many people attacked and some of them arrested and some of them we don't know till now where they are. Maybe police take them or we don't know their places. And some of them get some threats through email or SMS or something like that.
Sarvan sees the government crackdown as a response to the newness of public protest in Iraq.
They couldn't handle it. They didn't know how to respond to that sort of new ways of protesting, people protesting on the street. It was completely new. People, they get in the street, they were shouting, they were asking for their rights.
However, despite their similarity to other movements in the Arab Spring and a familiar government crackdown, these protests in Iraq have not gained the same media attention or traction. Rogai explains.
It appears to be a democracy. So while protesters in other Arab countries were rising up against dictators. Iraq supposedly got rid of its dictator 8 years ago. So in a sense, this rather sexy element of a battle of the wills, if you will, between a brutal dictator versus a crushed majority of people, that kind of element, that kind of interaction was not the case here in Iraq.
She adds that along with being smaller than protest movements seen in Egypt and Syria, the Iraqi protest movement is also less unified.
The protesters come from very different backgrounds. They have very different calls. So while there are people who are focusing on a call to end corruption and to provide better services, there are others who are protesting against the U.S. presence here and calling for this presence not to be extended. You see a lot of families coming to the square calling for the government to tell them the fate of their missing sons. So really multiple and very varying demands.
However, Sarvan feels that the reason for the struggling protest movement goes deeper to Iraqi society itself.
Activism, it's a new movement here. The structure of the society, so far, it hasn't got sort of the activism still, because we've got a very traditional society, which activism, it wasn't exist at the time. It's not easy process, to be honest.
However, despite these setbacks, the Iraqi protest movement is far from defeat. Protesters continue to gather on Fridays across Iraq and press forward in their hope of bringing reform to a struggling nation. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Dwider.
This is War News Radio. Several weeks ago, War News Radio examined a number of topics surrounding the unmanned drones that the United States military uses in the Middle East. Supporters of the drones say they are valuable strategic weapons because they can surgically remove high-value terrorists. Reprieve, a British human rights group, disagrees. In a return to the hotly debated topic, Stuart Russell profiles the organization's work on the drone issue.
Filing lawsuits against the United States government is a bold and ambitious act. Although she knows this, Tara Murray, a staff attorney at Reprieve, also understands the importance of the group's litigation against drones.
Though the U.S. tries to say that only militants are being killed, we know that that's simply not true. So we're hoping to end kind of this official denial that civilian deaths are taking place and to raise the awareness that civilian deaths are in fact taking place and to stop that behavior that's causing those deaths.
According to a report by the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy institute, the United States has launched more than 250 drone strikes in northwest Pakistan since 2004 in an effort to wipe out militants hiding in the region. Of all those killed in these attacks, the report claims that about 20% were civilians. Reprieve, a charity that usually works on human rights issues, believes there is a clear connection between drone strikes and the work it has done in the past. Historically, the group has fought what it sees as abuses of United States power, such as rendition, torture, and the death penalty. Reprieve views drone strikes as yet another example of this sort of misused power. Its anti-drone campaign, dubbed Project Bug Splat, is attempting to combat the killing of innocent Pakistani civilians. Reprieve's battle is fought in the courts through litigation and in society at large through a public awareness campaign. Murray clarifies the project's unusual name.
In a Washington Post article, a former CIA official stated that bug splat was a term used to describe the impact of a drone strike, of a missile that has been launched in a particular area. The idea of the project is just to raise public awareness and to call for accountability for what the U.S. is doing in Pakistan.
As part of Project Bug Splat, Reprieve recently opened a London exhibition of images by Pakistani journalist Noor Behram, a native of the Waziristan region where most of the drone attacks are reported. The exhibition displays pictures and videos which he says depict drone attacks and their aftermath. Mirza Shahzad Akbar, a Pakistani lawyer working with Reprieve on Project Bug Splat, says this is incredibly important because it shows the public the carnage that he says drones cause.
Before this, we haven't really had any photo images of what really happens after the drone strike. We hear a lot about it, but we don't really see what it does to humankind. So these photos are quite explanatory in that way, because some of the photos really show gruesome scenes where children's half-mutilated bodies or different organs just in pieces.
Akbar adds that the exhibition is also challenging claims made by the U.S. government that drone strikes do not harm civilians.
It's also evidence of civilian casualty and a larger number of civilian casualty in the drone strike, which is completely negating the narrative given by the U.S. saying that there are no civilian casualties or there's a very small number of civilian casualties in drones.
These civilian casualties are the foundation of REPREVE's legal argument. U.S. State Department legal advisor Harold Koh has repeatedly offered the Obama administration's view that the drone strikes are legal because they are in self-defense as part of an armed conflict with al-Qaeda. In a 2010 speech to the American Society of International Law, Koh said that, although they are highly undesirable, civilian deaths aren't technically illegal as long as they are not excessive in relation to the military advantage the U.S. gains from a strike. REPREVE disagrees, noting that most of the drone strikes occur in Pakistan, a country with which the United States is not officially at war. The group says this would make civilian deaths illegal under international law. Akbar explains his view.
Obama can say that they are in self-defense, but, you know, you need to have it legally validated from somewhere, and you don't in Pakistan's case. For Afghanistan, for Iraq, you have UN Security Council resolution. For Pakistan, you don't. Pakistan is not at war with U.S., and neither is U.S. with Pakistan. And actually, these two countries are allies in war against terror. So in that case, if a civilian organization of the United States take a unilateral action inside Pakistan, they're violating certain laws of international law.
According to Akbar, if the U.S. claims it is at war and acting in self-defense, then the Taliban and al-Qaeda can make this claim too. He says they could argue they are launching bomb attacks in the cities of Pakistan to protect themselves, thereby creating what he calls a cycle of terror. Akbar believes the U.S. must end this sort of cycle by taking the high moral ground.
I think all of us, and especially more than anyone else, states, countries, governments, they have to adhere more to rule of law than anyone else. I mean, we cannot expect the Taliban and militants to adhere to rule of law, but at least as state, we cannot go on acting illegally against these actors because, I mean, what makes us on a higher moral ground is the legality of our actions. So if we start taking illegal actions, I think we lose the high moral ground in this.
Murray thinks that the legal and moral solution to the terrorist attacks would be for the Pakistani government to arrest these actors.
We believe that this is a Pakistani law enforcement issue. This is something for the Pakistani government, the sovereign country of Pakistan, to deal with. And, you know, so we certainly believe that, you know, this is something that can be handled by law enforcement means as opposed to the U.S. coming in as, you know, an international police, so to speak, and conducting these extra legal activities in secret. We definitely believe that this is something that needs to be handled domestically.
Akbar says that whatever steps are taken to apprehend terrorists and militants hiding in Pakistan, it is incredibly important that the actions are legal under the rule of law.
They cannot go outside the rule of law and start killing because, you know, when you go outside the system and you go outside the accountability of law and under the rule of law, then you end up committing mistakes, and those mistakes are when you end up killing innocent people. So what I would suggest to U.S. is that whatever action they take, it should not be outside the bounds of law.
In the past, REPREVE has sought murder charges on behalf of the civilians killed in drone strikes against a CIA station chief in Islamabad. More recently, REPREVE is seeking international arrest warrants for John Rizzo, the former legal counsel of the CIA. A February interview in Newsweek says, Rizzo was involved in murder, as he sometimes puts it. Murray thinks this interview gives REPREVE a strong case against Rizzo.
John Rizzo has come forward and admitted that he signed off on targeted killings during the time that he was acting general counsel of the CIA. Once he retired late last year, he came forward in an interview earlier this year saying that he had sanctioned these murders, and he called them murders. He had sanctioned these murders in Pakistan. And so we feel that John Rizzo is a perfect person, you know, to bring forward in terms of litigation because of his own statement.
With Mirza Shahzad Akbar as their contact in Pakistan, REPREVE says it has unearthed the stories of Pakistani civilians who were affected by the drone strikes that occurred while Rizzo worked at the CIA. REPREVE files its legal cases on the behalf of these civilians.
I started off with one client named Karim Khan. His strike was on 31st of December 2009. His brother and son were killed in those, and it was simply reported in the newspaper that it had actually killed a militant, whereas no one really bothered to see who is actually dead. And people who died, they were government servants. So for a moment, if you think hypothetically, if there were the terrorists or militants required, they could have easily been arrested and apprehended by the government because they were government employees. They were going into government offices every time.
The personal stories of people who suffer because of these attacks add a human element to strikes that are often only vaguely described by the media.
There's another client, Sadaullah, aged 15, who lost both his legs and an eye in a drone strike at his house on 7th September 2009. And in the news, it was reported that that strike had killed Ilyas Kashmiri, but now we know that the Ilyas Kashmiri terrorist, he was killed in 2011, which still I think no one is 100% sure. But at that drone strike, no one really asked if Ilyas Kashmiri is not killed, who was actually really killed.
Akbar says that he hears so many of these sorts of stories. He speaks of yet another example.
We have another client who was a 15-year-old schoolboy who lost six of his family members. And he lost one of his eye and he had to be hospitalized for over 6 months because a missile sharpener went through his stomach and he was just a college student.
According to Akbar, the CIA and other US agencies offer no sort of clarification as to why Pakistani civilians have been hurt. They only claim that there have been minimal civilian casualties. Akbar is also frustrated that these legal filings have, so far, been largely ignored by both the Obama administration in the US and the government in Pakistan. War News Radio attempted to contact the White House, the Department of Defense, and the CIA on this issue, but received no response.
Now, for the American side, that if they're so convinced about their argument of self-defense, why don't they come and reply to our legal actions in courts in Pakistan? Or they can have us in U.S. I mean, we are very ready to come to U.S. if U.S. courts entertain us.
Akbar, Murray, and the rest of the lawyers at Reprieve working on Project Bugsplat clearly face an uphill battle in their legal fight. Despite opposition, security experts increasingly see drones as the next step in the evolution of warfare. Even if they are not successful in the courts, Reprieve believes its actions will raise the profile of the issue. A greater public awareness, they hope, will pressure the United States to rethink its actions. For War News Radio, I'm Stuart Russell. This is War News Radio. According to a recent Thomson Reuters Foundation expert poll, Afghanistan is the most dangerous country in the world for women. And in the primarily male-dominated society, many Afghans see playing sports as inappropriate for women. Clara Izupidis takes a look at the Afghan women's national soccer team and how they are fighting for women's rights in the country.
Shamila Kohistani remembers being one of the only girls playing soccer when she took up the sport in Afghanistan in 2004.
Right after the Taliban, I mean, 6 years, women weren't allowed to go anywhere, you know, like they weren't allowed to even leave the house alone. It's hard for them to go to school, like forget about playing a sport, you know.
For most people, soccer, or football, depending on where you're from, is just another sport, an extracurricular activity, a form of exercise, a fun sport to watch. But for the women in Afghanistan, it's a fight. And for the past several years, the Afghan women's national soccer team has been fighting the status quo of their country in order to play. Shamila Kohistani, current student at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, was one of the founding members of the team.
There was not many girls who wants to play soccer because a lot of people here, they consider it as a men's sport. So that when I started, I didn't get a lot of support.
She eventually found several other girls who wanted to play, and together they formed a team. It was not long before they found someone to coach them, and soon they started traveling to high schools, recruiting other girls to join. And in 2006, they held their first tournament in Kabul. The girls knew early on that they were doing something great. Kalita Popal, a recent player for the national team and the chairperson of the Women's Football Committee, put it simply, speaking from Norway.
Through football, my aim was to fight for women's rights.
Kohistani echoes with a similar sentiment.
I decided to do it because I want to be the first to change this. I took the risk, but I really wanted to do this.
The women have faced negative reactions from the people of Afghanistan, from simple discouragement to taunting and harassment. Kohistani remembers how some men responded to them playing soccer.
Sometimes would be playing, practicing, and guys would throw rock at us or like a stool saying like, oh, what are you doing? You think you can play soccer?
Both Popal and Kohistani agree that their society's traditions are holding back the progress of the national soccer team and women's rights. Though the women have been playing soccer for several years now, they've not seen any dramatic changes in the status of women in Afghanistan. Popal says,
they are not ready to accept that women can play football. Especially, they are not ready to accept this, that the women can go and work and play and do some sports. They are not ready for this.
Kohistani adds that perhaps the women's choice to play soccer has adversely affected their status in the eyes of Afghan men.
A lot of guys doesn't think like we are the good girls, you know? Like they think the girls are supposed to stay home. They're not supposed to go out, especially play sports. Men are always have been the one who control women, you know, like where to go, what to do. So now that they see women improving, so they don't like that.
Popal has experienced this response firsthand and says she was forced to flee her country after standing up to an official in the sports ministry. According to Popal, the official was withholding the girls' salaries and keeping them for himself and threatened her after she voiced these accusations in a TV interview.
He came with lots of bodyguards, with lots of guns in my office, and he told me that I will kill you. Why you went to TV against me? Why said these things against me? I said, I was not against you. It was all the truth that I said.
Popal states that his threats did not end there. She says he threatened her family, and he then accused her of being a terrorist, an accusation which prompted the police to warrant her arrest. Popal realized that she had to leave for her own safety and for the safety of her family. She left for India, then Denmark, and then finally ended up in Norway. Though she currently resides there, she continues to help the Afghan national soccer team. Popal was recently able to organize for the team to come to the Norway Cup. When Popal told her teammates all she had been through with a sports ministry official, the girls grew worried.
When they came here and I was talking with them, and I told them that about the situation, they were too much worried and they were crying, and they said that we are not going to play again in Afghanistan. We want to stop playing football.
But Popal encouraged the girls to continue. Despite the threats and their fears, the women's love for the game has kept them going.
But still, the girls want to play football and they want to fight for it.
So the women continue to fight to play soccer. And Kohistani says that they continue to fight for recognition and acceptance as equal to the men in their country.
But we never gave up for anything because we wanted to prove that we are strong, we are talented, all we need is opportunity.
They may still have a long way to go before qualifying for the next World Cup, but the women of the Afghan women's national soccer team have started to pave an important path for Afghan soccer and for Afghan women. For War News Radio, I'm Clara Izupidis.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Clara Izupidis and Dina Sherhan. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Eliana Biscard-Church.
And I'm Stuart Russell. Until next time, thanks for listening.